Daniel and redemption history. So you know how it works. We do an introduction, which will give some basic introductory thoughts about Daniel or each individual book. Then we look at the role in redemption history, and then we see what are the inner canonical themes in that book. Okay, so let's see if we can get a few fill-ins here in this session. Daniel was taken to Babylon in the first deportation, 605 B.C., when he was still a youth. The Babylonians habitually captured the best and the brightest from the royal families and the nations they conquered to indoctrinate them and train them for civil service. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, the chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. Now, of course, the idea of doing this is you get the best and your brightest, and you bring them in, you indoctrinate them, and then they work for you in bringing the rest of the people and the nation into Babylonian ideas. It's quite a picture of discipleship, really, isn't it? I mean, basically, you find the best and the brightest, so go to university students, train them, and then release them into society to begin to salt all of society. Great picture. Now, the structure in Daniel is unique. Number two, the first six chapters of Daniel are historical narrative. But the last six chapters are apocalyptic. Apocalyptic literature is characterized by an unveiling of future events using vision, symbols, graphic images. It presents a millennial kingdom that will soon destroy and replace the present evil age and its demonic rulers. Now, whenever we preach from Daniel, we almost always preach from the first six chapters, right? Can you ever think of when we've done a Daniel series, when we did 7 through 12? Probably. I don't imagine we ever did. What's that? That would have been, that's the narrative, yeah. Yeah. Maybe we should try the last six chapters sometime, huh? We've gleaned a lot from those first six chapters. Of course, those are great for preaching. I mean, those are all good stories, good narratives with a lot of drama already built in. So that's why there's a lot of preaching done in those first six chapters. But rarely do people venture beyond into those other chapters. They're a little bit more confusing and a little more difficult. Daniel's also unique. Not only does it have this two-part structure, but it's written in two different languages. It's Hebrew and Aramaic. Aramaic would have been the international language of the day. So it starts in Hebrew, and then in the middle section, it goes into Aramaic, and then it goes back to Hebrew in the end. Probably because there's some connection, because it was a court document, or they're using court documents from the Babylonian court, or maybe to make it relevant for Babylonians who spoke Aramaic. But two different languages. It's also the shortest of the major prophets. We call it a major prophet, and in the New Testament, in the Christian canon, it's listed as one of the major prophets. In the Hebrew canon, you know, the Hebrew canon has three divisions to it, right? There's the Torah, which is the first part, and then there's the Nevi'im, which is the prophets, the second part, and that's divided in two. There's the latter and the former and the latter prophets. And then there is the Ketuvim, which is the writings, and that's everything else. And the Hebrews, they had a hierarchical view of inspiration. So they believed that the Torah was the highest level of inspiration because it was God speaking himself. The prophets were the second level hierarchy because it was God speaking through prophets. But the writings were the third level of inspiration because it was man's ideas, hopefully inspired by God. But Christians generally think of the canon as there's no hierarchy in it. So everything's God's inspired word. Although probably in practice we tend to have sort of a hierarchy in our mind. We would think New Testament sort of trumps Old Testament, and Jesus' words sort of trump Paul's words. The red letters, yeah. Somehow they're a little higher, but anyway, in the Hebrew Bible, Daniel is not in the prophets. It's in the writings. So it's not even in the second hierarchy of inspiration. It's also the shortest of the major prophets, but even though it's the shortest, it's the most frequently studied of all the other 16 prophets, at least historically throughout the history of the church. Also, in New Testament prophecy, Daniel is referred more to than any other Old Testament book. So, you know, the people who really study those chapters 7 through 12, those are people who are focusing on eschatology. You know, if you go to an eschatology seminar, probably done by a premillennial dispensationalist, there'll be a lot of Daniel chapter 7 through chapter 12. That's why I wondered maybe it would be good sometime to incorporate that into our preaching, to give a covenantal, every nation victory view of those chapters to stop some of the craziness that's out there. Role in redemption history. The book is set in the context of world events from Nebuchadnezzar's first attack on Jerusalem to the rise of Cyrus the Great, so about 605 to the mid-530s. But the book also looks forward to the unfolding of historical events leading to the time of the ends when the Ancient of Days will assume his eternal throne. And Daniel's the first of the prophets to minister during the exile. Remember, we mentioned that the two primary events that all the Old Testament hangs on is the Exodus and the exile. Everything leads up to the Exodus prior to it, then after it looks back to God's mighty works of redemption, and then looks forward to the exile, experiences the exile, and then looks back to the exile. So all the prophetic ministry, we put them in three different categories. They're either pre-exilic, they prophesied before the exile, they're exilic, they prophesied during the exile, or post-exilic, after the exile. And Daniel is the first prophet to minister during the exile period. Because the full exile really doesn't start till 586. Remember, there's two deportations before the final destruction of the temple, the final deportation of a vast number of Israelites to Babylon. Number two, Daniel is represented as a two-dimensional, an idealized character in the text. The narrative never reveals any faults or sins in his character. He's depicted as the ideal righteous man. This is a narrative technique similar to the presentation of Solomon in the book of Chronicles. The purpose is to provide an ideal model of the proper way to resist oppression and persecution. So I used to really be bothered by Daniel because of this, because it sort of went against my idea of the whole purpose of the Old Covenant. The Old Covenant is to show that apart from Christ, nobody actually lives righteously. And so that's why all the other Old Testament narratives, they go out of their way to show us the flaws in these Bible characters, right? And yet there's no flaw in Daniel. It's like he's like a perfect dude, right? And so then finally, through reading and study, I understood that there's a reason for this. This is a narrative technique. It doesn't mean to imply that somehow Daniel was perfect in all his ways. Obviously, he was a sinner like we are, in need of redemption. But it's a choice of the author to present him in such a way, because he's two-dimensional, you see? David is three-dimensional character. I mean, we get to see the good, the bad, the ugly. Daniel, you just see the good. He's always doing right, saying the right things, always doing the right thing. He's idealized. And so sometimes you do that because you show this is how we should respond during times of oppression and persecution. So no significant flaws in him, and that's the reason why. Intercanonical themes. Kingdom is the one that's the most predominant. The primary theme in Daniel is the sovereignty of God over the nations. Yahweh is portrayed as the great shaper of the events of history, putting one leader forward and removing another at his will. God's sovereignty over the nations is depicted in every chapter of the historical narrative. I think you have a chart there on your notes, don't you, of each chapter? Yeah? No? Okay, thank you. Carl Armerding says, from the viewpoint of a human observer, it seemed that the religion of the Hebrews had been completely discredited. Their God had apparently shown himself inferior to the mighty gods of Assyria and Babylon, for he seemed unable to deliver his people from the worshipers of Asher, Bel, and Nebo. So the whole narrative in Daniel relates a series of contests between false gods of human invention and the one true sovereign Lord and creator of heaven and earth. That's why, you know, that's a great way. Most of the time when we've done Daniel, we've done bits and pieces of it, or we've done it as a part of other series. But if we ever want to do a series on God sovereign over every area of life, those six chapters would be great, one for each sermon, because in each chapter we see God's sovereignty revealed in another aspect of it, that he really is in control of all things. It also could be a good series when it's voting season. We vote this year, or is that 2016? 2016, you know, so because it really, one of the primary reasons of from the original author is to show God's relationship to civil government and how the church should react and respond in view of civil government. So I don't know if we're doing a series related to the, do we have something planned for 2016 about election?
We have an election leadership series.
Yeah, kind of tied in. Yeah. Yeah. But we've Yeah. We're going to talk about how bad the character was. Yeah, rise and fall. That's good, yeah. So we do the rise and the fall. Yeah.
Are you built up a lot?
Oh, yeah, you can't even use that, can you? Brand violation right there. Those are the six chapters. And we see God's sovereignty each chapter. God's sovereign over the affairs of men. You know, because you understand the mindset in the ancient Near East is they weren't pantheists, they were panentheists. They believed that their particular God had control over a geographical region. And so if you were in their particular region, their God was the God of that region. And one of the motivations behind military conquest is because their God wanted to attack the domain of other gods. And so what would happen in a military conquest on one particular nation, they would really pit their gods against the gods of the nation they were attacking. If the attacking army conquered, then what it would mean is that their God was more powerful than the other gods. So if you were a defeated nation, that meant that your God was an inferior God to the nation that defeated you. And so here we see over a period of time, because in 609, remember that Josiah rebels against Egypt and decides to attack Egypt. He's killed in that battle, and as a result of that, now Egypt has to pay, Judah has to pay tribute to Egypt. So in essence, the gods of Egypt are greater than the gods of Judah. And what happens in the Battle of Carchemish in 605, Nebuchadnezzar defeats both Assyria and Egypt, and so now all the vassal states of Egypt and Assyria come under the control of Nebuchadnezzar. One of those, of course, Judah at that time is the vassal state of Egypt. And so he comes under control. That's why he goes to Jerusalem, takes Daniel and some of the other guys as sort of a token to say this is a vassal state. You can still have your own king, but that king is really under my authority as long as you become a puppet. You know, you just do what I say and we'll let you stay there, but you're a puppet ruler. And so the whole message in those six chapters is that although it looks like the God Yahweh has been defeated, in reality, he's in control of all the gods. And so chapter after chapter, his sovereignty shows up and all the other gods are seen for what they are, inferior, really demonic forces. That's good, isn't it? Any thoughts, comments? Yeah.
Paul, you were talking about Daniel being a good eschatological book. How does this compare with Revelation?
Yeah, there's a lot of quotes from it, you know, a lot of references to it. So people who study eschatology, you know, there's a couple major sections you have to deal with. So you have to deal with Zechariah. There's a lot of apocalyptic eschatological themes there. You got to deal with those last six chapters. You got to deal, of course, with Matthew 24 and then Revelation. So almost all eschatological teaching comes out of that. And, you know, a lot of the, most of the people who are making money on eschatology, let's say it how it really is, most of the ones who are making money are teaching a premillennial, dispensational eschatology. You know, because it's dramatic, right? And it's, you can make all these storylines and 666 and, you know, beasts and temples and various things. So they spend a lot of time in those chapters. You know, I pretty much avoided them myself. Have you guys, I mean, anybody done any serious study on chapters 7 through 12? June? You have? A study? Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, your own view. Divertiology, huh? Yeah, but you're not a dispensationalist, are you?
No.
Oh, good. Because then we'd have to kill you. Is he?
No.
Tell the truth now. Tell the truth.
I'm just kidding you.
Okay, yeah. You know, we have a dispensationalist among us, not here in the Philippines, but in our every nation ranks. Yeah, he's a published author, too. He published his book on a dispensational premillennial eschatology. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. No. He wanted us to, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we had to read the, June and Noel and I, we read the manuscript, didn't we? Yeah, sounded like John Hagee. You know John Hagee here, is he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, when you listen to where they...
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Science.
Yeah. They seem so, like, it must be true.
Yeah. Especially the last few weeks of Blood Moon and
everything. Oh, yeah, everybody's into the Blood Moon.
We can add the Back to the Future.
Back to the Future, yeah. You know, if they prophesy the Cubs' victory... Anything's possible, right? Well, you know what really sold in our country, I don't know if they made it over here, was the Left Behind series.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they sold in paperback and all the different versions something like 25 million copies. I mean, massive amount of money. I think the... With Nicolas Cage, God, that was embarrassing, wasn't it?
It was so bad.
But you know, he's got a reputation that he'll take any role. He sure fulfilled it in that movie. I didn't see it. I didn't want anybody to know that I would actually go to see a movie like that. Ghost Rider. Yeah, Ghost Rider. Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's back in the spirit here. At the age of 25.
I have one question.
Yeah, go ahead. Becomes the god, yeah.
Is the god,
it's true.
Or sometimes a nation.
Yeah.
I mean, I can imagine for a Russian, you know, for somebody involved in the Russian military, they think that they're the most powerful soul.
Yeah, no, they had to, yeah.
When did the shift begin towards that kind of thinking? It seemed like they were so spiritual in this culture, and now everything is just
secular. Yeah.
It's based on, not just not just rational thinking, but more, the idolatry of self, I guess. It's like, you know, when did the world start shifting?
Yeah.
Become such, thinking this way that, you know, it's not spiritual, it's just man-centered.
Yeah, well, in Europe, it's the Age of Enlightenment.
Okay.
Yeah, so 1700s, really. By the time the 1700s were over, skepticism and disregard of the supernatural became throughout Europe. You know, the natural progression, then it takes the leap over to the U.S. It takes a while to take root there, and... You know, then from the U.S. and we import it to Asia, you know, in movies, in music, in television, in the media, that kind of skeptical idea gets transferred. So certainly Age of Enlightenment, although I'm reading Martin Gilbert's biography of Winston Churchill, and we just crossed into 1944, so through the war years. And, you know, when you think about Hitler... And the way he was able to get German people so committed is essentially he took this basic idea of the deity of the German nation.
Right.
It wasn't really that he was the God. It was the embodiment of the German nation, the spirit of the German nation. We are the Aryan race. The chosen people. And I'm also reading, I'm reading just a fiction work now called The Doomsday Testament. And but there's a lot of, it's historical fiction, you know, it's a mystery thing, but they're tying in a lot to the Third Reich's fascination with the occult. And this guy Heinrich Himmler, he was one of the architects of the death camp. And he was the person that was in charge of researching all occult history. Because, you know, the swastika, you know, that's an ancient Buddhist symbol, you know, a neo-pagan symbol. And so they were researching the pagan roots of ancient Germany and looking for the roots of the Aryan nation and completely fascinated with the occult. And he built this massive castle that was going to be a whole... A whole complex dedicated to the occult. And Himmler gave all of his, he was in charge of the SS troop. Remember the SS, you know, with the two S's, right, which are lightning strike, which are pagan symbols. And he gave all of his SS troops, this is out of his own budget, he gave them the death head rings. They all had these magic rings, you know. Supposedly they would give them powers and various different kinds of things. And whenever an SS trooper was slain in battle, his companion was tasked to get that ring and deliver it back to Himmler. And he created a shrine to all the fallen people with their ring there. And there's a whole massive occult foundation to the whole Nazi regime. And by deifying the nation, that's how he was able to rally the people to be so obsessed. You know, I mean, by 42, really, when America joined the war, it was obvious that Hitler could not win. I mean, they all knew. And common sense would have been an armistice, you know, sue for peace. But somehow he convinced his soldiers to just fight to the death. And, I mean, the only way you do that is you it's like you're fighting for God, you know, but not the God, like the nation is God. So that wasn't that long ago. Still with us. Fascinating. Okay? Any thoughts about Himmler? Yeah.
So it's I think it's just for History Channel.
But still alive.
I might suggest that History Channel is less than credible sometimes. You know, they have a major audience of people who are fascinated in occult. You know, they have a lot of those secrets of the, and, you know, some of that research is, you just ought to double check some of those, you know. It's like, it's probably right underneath Wikipedia as a trusted source. Not even the same level. Underneath that. I've watched, you know, some of them are reputable, you know, but some of them, you know, they do a lot of things about the Bible, too, and, you know, they do a lot of those, and they get every kind of quack and controversialist and weirdo in there.
That's the worst. Aliens.
Aliens, yeah, right.
They also use biblical manuscripts
for it. Sure they do, yeah, sure, yeah. Well, Ezekiel, you know, was that spinning, those eyes and that spinning thing that... Yeah. Yeah, Eric Von Donegan, right, that wrote that, wasn't it?
But there's water in Mars, so...
No, there's not. Or is there? Is that in the movie? I missed the movie. It's come and gone.
Recently, there's been water by NASA, but there's water in Mars. Just right before the movie came out, so it's kind
of... Okay, yeah. I know, but I missed it. It's gone now in the theaters. Is it?
It's still showing in PowerPoint.
Okay, I need to see it. I don't want to see it. I couldn't get to it, and I ended up seeing... Have you seen Mount Everest in 3D?
No.
I mean, just Everest? Oh, my gosh. That was terrifying. Huh? Yeah, yeah. You know, it's based on a true story.
But were they true to the story?
Well, you know, there's a lot of controversy about that. You know, there's different... Have you read all the... There's a massive infighting about what actually happened. So... A lot of people are upset about it, but anyway, I mean, it was from eyewitness, so, you know, there's been several people who survived that wrote books, and there's some controversy between their telling of it, but anyway, it's a fast, especially in 3D, you know, because they're,
wow.
Yeah, I saw it in the IMAX 3D. I'm scared of heights, too. Oh, my gosh. You know, just the filming. I was fascinated how they filmed that. Whew, that's worth seeing if you what the heck? Where are we? Number two. Himmler. And then I saw Pan. Oh, man, that is the worst movie. Don't see that. Did you see that? Don't.
I never want to watch another Pan movie again.
Yeah, no, don't. Yeah. We should pan that movie. At the age of 25, we're talking about, we're Ezekiel, right? Oh, no. Oh, no, number one. Okay, you ready? Ezekiel, yes. Ezekiel was born 622. We know that one of the interesting things about Ezekiel is he gives exact chronological references. At least 13 times in his writing, he dates it to the year and the month. So he's the opposite of Jeremiah. If you remember when we studied Jeremiah, almost impossible to put a chronology of Jeremiah's writings. Ezekiel's a lot easier because he gives exact months and days. So I appreciate him. He probably had context as one of his themes. And so we know he was born 622. Now that's significant. That's still during the end of Josiah's revival, but beginning of Judah's slide to judgment. So he spent his early years in Jerusalem, where he probably heard the preaching of Jeremiah, Zephaniah, and Habakkuk. But then at the age of 25, he was taken to Babylon during the second deportation in 597. 5 years later, at age 30, he began his prophetic ministry to a community of exiles living among the Kebar River. Have you spent much time in Ezekiel? Ezekiel is a book that I had deliberately passed over for about 35 years. I wasn't big on the Old Testament for the most part. And the prophets, I just never could get them. And so it's only been really in the last 3 years I've really been inspired by Jeremiah and Isaiah. I'm still freaking out a little bit over Ezekiel. Anybody here? You a big Ezekiel fan or spend much time there? Did you get much?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Strange dude. Now, some important things about him, though, he was born in a priestly family. And the year 30, when he began his prophetic ministry, that would have also been the year he began his priestly ministry, because you start as a priest at 30. And so because of his priestly background and his role, there's a repeated emphasis on the temple. So, you know, as a man of the temple, you would be interested in the temple. And so it shows up a lot in his writings. His emphasis on the temple, the glory of the Lord in the temple or departing the temple, the behavior of the priests shows up in his writings a lot. And there's a lot about the future temple in Ezekiel. So certainly interested in the kind of things that priests would be interested in. Now, his ministry was primarily to the Jewish exiles who were living in Babylon prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. So that would have been 597 to 586. And then his ministry continued to all the exiles that came in the third and final deportation. But a lot of his ministry, so he's ministering to the Jews in Babylon at the same time that Jeremiah is ministering to the Jews who are still, there's still a chance for repentance, or probably at that point it's past, and are still in Jerusalem and Judah. Simultaneous, at least there's an overlap at that particular point. Now, Ezekiel used multiple literary devices to communicate his message: drama, allegory, parable, proverbs, funeral dirges, visions, oracles, symbolic actions, etc. There's hardly any other book of the Bible that uses as many different literary forms as Ezekiel. He's famous for props. Yeah. So he's like the preacher that loves to bring the props in, you know? Any of you guys like that? Who's our prop preacher in Victory? Is Sonny a prop guy? Okay, yeah, I would have thought he might be a... Yeah. Yeah. Certainly Ezekiel was. Theologians call him sign acts. Sign acts. Sign hyphen acts. So they're an act that's a sign. And there's a whole bunch of them. So he was commanded by God to cook his food using human excrement as his fuel. Animal? Yeah, yeah. But God wanted it to be human because that would make your food unclean. And that's a sign that the people of God are going to be taken into exile and they're going to have to eat unclean food. It's a sign act. Also, there's a really strange one, and I went back and read that prior to this meeting, is God told him to pack his bags like he's going to exile. So he was supposed to, like an exile would, you know, get only the important things that you can take and wrap it like an exile. And he was to leave his house every day with his bags and then return every night. And that was supposed to be a sign: pack your bags. Wow. You're going in exile. So he had to do the same routine every day as a sign act. But the one that was probably the most poignant is when his wife dies, God commands him he is not allowed to mourn or to weep. So there's a period of mourning, right? You know, a 30-day period of mourning when a wife would die like that, in that situation. And he was commanded he could not, he wouldn't wear the mourning clothes, he couldn't weep, he couldn't do any of the visual signs of mourning. So he was not to shed a tear, he was not to weep, he was not to have any emotion about the death of his wife. And that was symbolizing that God will not mourn the destruction of Jerusalem or the temple. That's a pretty powerful sign act. And, you know, what a challenge, okay? Your wife's dead. Not one sign of emotion out of you as a prophet. Thank you, Rico. Thank you, Rico. Yeah, we needed that. It was getting a little too serious in the room. Filipinos can't take that. There are three sections in Ezekiel's writing. Section 1, proclaimed to Judah before the fall of Jerusalem, itemized their sins and the reasons for God's judgment. Section 2, proclaimed to the Gentile nations that they would experience the same fate as Judah because they had committed the same sins. And section 3 proclaimed to the exiles in Babylon that God would restore the fortunes of his people and restore his glory in the earth. Sky, did you get a message from him? Is it going to work or what are we doing?
Yeah, I think this is 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay, so what time?
11:45.
Okay, good. We'll go 5 more minutes then. Okay, role in redemption history. After more than 55 years of apostasy under Manasseh and Amon, that was the father and grandfather of Josiah, Josiah brought renewed hope to Judah. Unfortunately, it came too late. When he was killed in 609, the nation began a quick decline that led to the final destruction of Jerusalem. So as I said earlier, his defeat was at the hand of the Egyptians, and Judah is now under their authority. But in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar defeated the combined Assyrian and Egyptian forces at Carchemish, that's Carchemish, Carchemish. One of the most important battles in history in Carchemish. Jehoiakim, which was the king at that time, formerly a puppet of the Egyptian pharaoh, now became a reluctant vassal of Babylon. People who look at military battles and the most significant battles in history always list Carchemish as one of the most significant battles, because in that battle, Babylon destroyed Egypt and Assyria, and from that point on, they would never rise to the same significance or power. It's essentially the end of the Egyptian and the Assyrian Empire. I mean, although it lingered for quite a long time, for any kind of serious significance, it put an end, it destroyed two great world powers, and they would never again rise to international significance. Egypt's still around. Assyria, of course, is long gone. Now, number 3, when Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim, really confusing those last 5 kings of, their names sound a lot alike, and some of them come in rapid succession. When Jehoiakim challenged Babylon's authority, Nebuchadnezzar attacked. In other words, he got tired of being a puppet, and he said, we're not going to take it anymore. And so he wouldn't pay the tribute, and Nebuchadnezzar said, okay, we'll explain it to you a little bit clearer. And so he brings an army, laid siege to the city, and finally, 597, the city surrenders to Nebuchadnezzar. This is the second deportation. So this is when Ezekiel is taken into captivity. Now, number 4, Nebuchadnezzar then established Zedekiah, Z-E-D-E-K-I-A-H, Zedekiah, as a regent vassal over Judah. During this time, false prophets in Judah prophesied that Nebuchadnezzar's power was soon to be broken and the exiles would triumphantly return. Zedekiah believed the false prophets and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. In 588, the Babylonian army laid siege to Jerusalem and finally destroyed the city 2 years later. That's the danger about listening too closely to people who are giving very specific, detailed prophecies about the last days. Right? I remember early in ministry, I hadn't been in ministry, this was probably early 1980, and one of my church members, their family, they were really rabid Hal Lindsey, late great Planet Earth people, and they were convinced, that the Antichrist, the rapture was probably that year, but even possibly that month. And so what they did, based on confidence in that prophecy, they got as many credit cards as they could, and they just ran up huge debts. Yeah. They said, and their whole idea is, let's just run up the debts and leave them for the Antichrist. Well, that's stupid, but not as stupid as Zedekiah listening to these false prophets saying, thus says the Lord, Nebuchadnezzar, I will defeat his power. And so Zedekiah believed him, although Jeremiah was saying, do not pay attention to false prophets. God has said very plainly, and he kept telling Zedekiah, yield, give in, don't fight him, submit, and it'll go well with you. But Zedekiah believed the false prophets, and so Nebuchadnezzar was forced to come, and he set up a siege against Jerusalem. It lasted 18 months. The book of Lamentations chronicles that time period. And of course, it got so bad during that time period because of a lack of food that mothers were taking their newborn babies, killing them and boiling their flesh so they had something to eat. I mean, you know it's gotten pretty desperate when mothers can take their babies and kill their baby. I mean, you think about our wives, you know, and could you imagine that, you know, when that baby came? And I mean, what state would you have to get in that you could bring it yourself to kill your baby, boil it, put a little barbecue sauce on it, and then eat it? You know, horrible to think about, isn't it? So it was in this period of international turmoil and unrest that Ezekiel ministered. Well, that's probably enough for now. It's 11 o'clock. Let's take a break according to that clock. And we come back at 10 after, okay? And then we're just going to go till 11:45. All right? 10 after.